You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Well, we have got a special guest on the podcast today. Welcome, Alisa Childers.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's amazing to have you on campus because I've listened to your podcast for a long time. So it's really fun to have you in our studio. Tell our listeners why you're here this week.
Well, I'm here for Summit Camp, mm-hmm. which is this is my first day being here. And we had two sessions and we had, I think, such a great time. I mm-hmm. loved interacting with the students and kind of hearing their questions mm-hmm. and what they're thinking about. So it's been a great day.
Yeah, it's a wonderful organization. If you're not familiar with it, I would highly encourage everyone to check it out, especially if you have teenagers. Just all the resources, the camps, all the materials for students are just incredibly, incredibly strong materials. So we'll just jump right in. You were talking with students today. I was just listening to you about deconstruction specifically. You have a new book out about the topic. It's a very popular topic right now, and which, you know, is not necessarily a good thing, but it's good that we're talking about it. Can you tell us a little bit about your own faith journey and how this topic became something you're so passionate about?
Oh, I love this question because this is actually a topic I've been thinking about mm-hmm. for probably 15 years. So I guess now it's been about 14 years ago, I went through a faith crisis. Now, mm-hmm. I had spent my entire life as a committed Christian, loved Jesus with all my heart, had spent some time in the contemporary Christian music industry. Mm-hmm. And after I came off the road, we weren't touring anymore. My husband and I started going to a church in Middle Tennessee, Bible Belt. It was an evangelical church. We loved it. Mm-hmm. And the pastor pulled me aside and invited me to come to a smaller study group. Mm-hmm. And I was really excited because I thought, man, I'm really going to get to know the why behind the what of my beliefs. We were going to dig really deep, seminary level stuff, he said. Mm-hmm. And so it was that class that I didn't realize at the time. The pastor had already been through deconstruction. He hadn't really told anybody that, but he did tell us he was an agnostic mm-hmm. in the class. So it was just private. We weren't supposed to talk about mm-hmm. it outside, but which was very disorienting and confusing for me because right. he had spent 8 months winning my respect and my trust. I really, really trusted that we were on the same page, mm-hmm. that we believed the same thing. But it turned out to not be so. And so for the 4 months that I lasted in the class, all the core beliefs that I had held my whole life about God, Jesus, and the Bible were deconstructed. They mm-hmm. were explained away. And so this propelled me into a faith crisis. Now, here's where the deconstruction conversation comes into it. I wrote my first book, Another Gospel, mm-hmm. about that journey. And in that book, I call what happened to me deconstruction, because I thought that's what happened to me. That was the best word I had at the time. Mm-hmm. I had come to the edge of agnosticism, nearly lost my faith, took years of study to rebuild, and I'm so thankful to God for his faithfulness in that to help me study and rebuild all of that. But it was hard work. It was agonizing. It was painful. It was disorienting. And so in the book, I called it deconstruction. But the interesting thing is when I went online and started to talk about my deconstruction, the deconstructionists, the people who are leading that movement online, would come on and say, "You didn't deconstruct."
Huh.
And they say, "In fact, you don't even understand deconstruction if you think you deconstructed." And I would be like, "Well, you weren't there, but okay, but why? Why?" Because I was thinking deconstruction is really just kind of pulling everything apart, right. deciding what you believe, and then putting your worldview back together, which is, I think, how a lot of people think of the word. But they were saying, "No, you didn't deconstruct because you still hold toxic theology."
Okay, so you didn't go all the way.
Well, what's weird about that is I kind of did go all the way, but I came back to believing that Jesus is Lord, that humans are sinful, that hell is a real place, these kinds of things. And they said, "No, that's toxic theology." So I thought, okay, so actually you have to come to certain conclusions to really consider it deconstruction. And so what I learned when I really studied deconstruction, I ended up agreeing with them. You're right, I didn't deconstruct. What I did was I call it a faith crisis now, because deconstruction is a very specific method. It's a way that people are assessing their beliefs. It's not just taking apart your beliefs, figuring out what's true, and then putting back together your worldview. Mm. It's a very specific way of doing that. And so ultimately what it is a shift of authority from the worldview of trusting the Bible, even objective truth as a larger category. Mm. So it's a shift from that to the authority of the self. So in the deconstruction movement, everything is about assessing your beliefs based on what you feel harmed by or helped by, what you think is toxic or healthy, what you think is oppressive or liberating. But it's all based on you as you're kind of the objective standard. You're the truth maker. And so that's the message we're trying to get out to the church, is that it's so tempting to use that word. Even I used it to describe maybe something that might be a healthy process of searching for truth. But that's not what the way it's manifesting in culture. Mm. It's very much a deconversion from the authority of objective truth.
Do you find, I hate to use the word trendy, but do you find that this is kind of trending? Like, is there like a TikTok hashtag about deconstruction? I mean, is this the level that we're at now?
Yeah, no, deconstructionists would cringe at me saying it's trendy, but it really is. It's something that, you know, if you want to be kind of considered enlightened and spiritually mature, you're going to want to be in deconstruction. And I think this is what's being sold to so many of our young people, even by well-meaning evangelical leaders who might say, you know what, you can deconstruct, just deconstruct in a healthy way according to the Bible. But that's by nature not what deconstruction is.
Right.
You don't deconstruct with the Bible. That's not deconstruction. And so that's really the message we're trying to get out, especially to young people. I loved getting to talk to the students and say, look, I know many of you might even be using this word to describe what you're going through. Maybe you're making your faith your own. Maybe you've had some serious doubts, maybe even a faith crisis. But I would just urge you to resist that kind of trendy language of deconstruction and just keep our words historically Christian and biblical. Mm. And we don't need a postmodern word to describe a process that we should all be doing anyway. We should be investigating our beliefs.
So that's like a healthy process of just maturing in your faith is what you're saying, you know, asking some questions in a healthy, you know, in a healthy church or in a healthy context with a mentor or something, or just seeing what the Bible says, ultimately. Okay. So
using the Bible as your authoritative source for truth. Now, some people think they have doubts about the Bible, and that's okay. You know, we're not saying don't doubt the Bible. But what we're saying is, if you can't just trust the Bible as your authoritative source for truth, then search for reasons why you can or can't trust the Bible. But make sure your search is in the realm of objective truth and not just being led by your feelings and your own heart.
Right. Tell me about, because you grew up in a Christian family. I know they weren't always a Christian family. Your dad, you told the students earlier, your dad was a hippie, basically, in a band, rock band, traveling around. And, you know, Jesus got a hold of him at some point in his life. And then you were raised basically in a home that preached in the streets and all throughout LA, I think you said, Southern California. Yeah. So what did your family think when you started going through this? And did they know you were going through this?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I don't even think I fully understood what was happening to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't talk to anybody about it, really, because I would kind of say little things here and there to try to get some information, but I was afraid that other people would lose their faith. I didn't want anyone to lose their faith. And I don't even think I really understood the depth of what was going on with me till later. Mm. But I do remember asking my dad like some questions that I had, and I appreciated that he wasn't rattled by my questions. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't react in fear.
Yeah.
And that made me actually feel like I could open up to him a little bit more so I kind of say, well, I'm taking this class and they're kind of saying these things. And so I remember my dad just opening the Bible with me and saying, well, you know, so why does that rattle you so much? What is it about that that's causing you so much emotional distress? And then when I saw he wasn't rattled by it, that actually made me feel very safe to investigate those questions in a way that that I didn't feel like I was feeling fearful or anything like that.
Yeah. So you concluded that you were not, in fact, deconstructing, and you were asking your dad some questions. So say there is someone, you know, a student, whether it's a college or high schooler, like you just spoke with, and they were deconstructing. What would some of those signs be, or what were some of those things that like parents or pastors should be looking for and how they can help?
Well, I would say first, if somebody tells you they're deconstructing, that's actually a really good sign. Mm. And that means they're probably just using the word to mean something like, I'm trying to make my faith my own, or engage my doubts, or maybe I'm having a faith crisis. Mm-hmm. And that's great. If they're telling you, then just ask them what they mean.
Yeah.
What do you mean by deconstruction? What does that word mean? And if they say, well, I'm really having a hard time, I'm trying to figure out what I believe, that's great. You can disciple them them through that. They're mm-hmm. probably not deconstructing like what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But when someone is really deconstructing, according to the definition that we've, you know, kind of observed it mm-hmm. manifesting culture, they're probably not going to tell you about it. They're mm-hmm. not, they've actually probably already decided you're an unsafe or toxic person mm-hmm. because of what you believe. And so although they might be going to church with you, they might be mm-hmm. kind of keeping quiet about it. They're probably finding community online. This is a very social media driven thing. So I would really encourage parents, if you still have teenagers in your house, we just don't let our kids do social media. Yeah. There's so many different types of social contagions mm-hmm. that can be found on social media that mm-hmm. 14 and 15 year olds just cannot, they don't have the critical thinking to be able to navigate. Yeah. So we just don't do social media. I'd really encourage you to limit that or just not have it altogether. Yeah. But also just realize that where they're coming from is not a place of going like, is what my parents think true? Mm-hmm. They already think it's toxic mm-hmm. and unhealthy. So if you realize the nature of what's happening to your loved one, then you can know how to navigate that. So I always tell parents, and this is the sad thing for me, is that night after night when I speak, I'll have an elderly couple mm-hmm. come up to me and say, you know, our adult child is deconstructed. They've told us we're toxic. Mm-hmm. They won't talk to us anymore. And so what I try to tell people is that it's really okay that if there's tension in the relationship and you sense that someone's deconstructing, and the signs of that will be, you know, sometimes they start posting about it on social media. Yeah. They'll post that deconstruction hashtag or the ex-evangelical hashtag, or they might be saying, you know, progressive talking points mm-hmm. politically. They might be talking about the Bible just being a human book, and they might be just kind of coming at it from a place of mm-hmm. wanting to tear down the foundations of Christianity, if they're even talking to you. But the advice we give in the book is that it's really okay that if the most urgent need is just to stay in their life, just do that. You don't need to fix their theology over coffee. You know, Susie knows why you're calling her for coffee. She doesn't want to go to coffee with you. So, you know, just try to maintain the relationship and do whatever you can to just live the beauty of the gospel out in front of them. Let them see the joy and the peace of Jesus in your life. Because I really suspect that when people start getting to the bottom of this rainbow and find out there's no pot of gold, they might be coming back to their Christian parents mm-hmm. and saying, okay, like, I think I took this a little too far.
Yeah.
I think we're already starting to see some of that. So don't panic. Maybe ask for definitions, ask clarifying questions, but ultimately it's okay to just kind of put theology on the side and just try to stay in their life.
Right. And pray for them. And
that's right. Course, yes. Right. You can totally, don't underestimate the power of prayer. Yeah. You can pray. You're not powerless.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, things like perhaps it's a social contagion, and, you know, people are throwing around the word toxic a lot. I mean, these are some really strong terms. You know, can you think of any other examples of things that would be similar to this?
Like a social contagion? Mm-hmm. Well, I think the trans ideology is something of a social contagion. I think that's been fairly well demonstrated when we went from people who were legitimately affected by gender dysphoria being less than 1% of the population and primarily men. Fast forward now, it's increased 4,000% and is primarily affecting young teenage girls. I mean, that is a sign that it's a social contagion. And I think that one is also social media driven. I don't know if you've read the book, Irreversible Damage by
Abigail
what's her
Schreier.
Name? Yes, Abigail Schreier. I mean, that's the book that really opened my eyes to the social contagion of that. But I think social media in general is just a factory for social contagions, especially the way the algorithms are fine-tuned to keep giving you content that you like, and then you get in an echo chamber and you don't know what's true anymore. Yep. So,
reinforces everything. And then the other word that you said a few times that kind of jumped out at me was toxic. You know, it's everything is toxic.
Everything is toxic.
Everything is triggering. Everything is, you know, where is that coming from, do you think?
So this is one that is really hard for me to understand. I just did a podcast with Ann Kennedy where we were talking about kind of the nature of the ex-evangelical movement. And one of the things she had highlighted was that there's just a real lack of respect for elders. There's a lack of maybe awareness of history or something like that. And that's the thing I think has been puzzling to me, is that for you to just declare your parents toxic, I mean, do they not realize they're going to have kids that are going to grow up and think they're toxic? And so it's like a lack of foresight, I think, because and lack of respect, I think, for previous generations, as Anne pointed out. But I think that's also kind of a component of postmodernism, is this idea that there is no grand meta-narrative. And so your parents had this grand meta-narrative of reality, and they're just kind of taught you all they knew, bless their hearts. But, you know, you know better
you
now.
You know better, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's a very arrogant, I just hate to say it that way, but in my experience, it's a very arrogant movement that has no respect for people who have gone before us. I mean, you think about even Middle Ages, they call it the Dark Ages, but these guys are like inventing things. They're speaking multiple languages. They're doing math.
Yeah.
I mean, think about all the people that were scientists and mathematicians and theologians and philosophers and artists.
Right.
And, you know.
And they grew their own food.
And they, it's like, I don't know if we're smarter than them. I'm just actually not sure we are.
Well, those are great points. You know, in some sense, it's like, oh, there's nothing new under the sun. People have been questioning their faith for decades. What's different about this, do you think?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question, a great point. I mean, we've always had people walking away from the faith. Even in the New Testament, we read about Demas, who fell in love with things of the world, you know. And so we've always had that going on. But I think what's different about this is that social media component. So now, whereas before you might have had a Bertrand Russell or somebody leave the faith and write a book about it, most people who left the faith would just kind of go away quietly and live their lives. But now you have an almost evangelistic zeal to
kind of bring a bunch with you when you
leave.
That's right,
to deconvert. And that's because they think it's toxic. They think it's virtuous to take as many people as possible. So that's why you have the hashtag. And also, I think that when you have numbers, you have courage. So you have this community of people online. Let's say you grew up in a Christian church and you don't like what you've been taught. Maybe you don't like biblical sexuality or ethics or something. Well, it used to be, you know, there would have been kind of a sense of shame in that. There would have been a whole community of people going, you know, kind of pushing against you. And it would have been maybe difficult to find people that would agree with you. But now you have a whole slew of people waiting to affirm your every whim, to celebrate.
Just at one click and you've got all these people cheering for you.
And it's so true. Like, this is not, it can't be more starkly demonstrated than a post I saw when I was researching, where somebody came in the comments and said, "You guys, I think I actually just today now don't believe in hell anymore." And there was an absolute avalanche of congratulations, celebration, yay, welcome to the team. I mean, just people. And I would imagine that person probably still had a little bit of fear of God in them by holding on to that so long. But then when they let go of it, the number of people that are going to affirm and support and celebrate that has got to give a little bit of courage to going ahead and letting go of some of those things.
What can churches be doing just to be, you know, really aware of this challenge, and how can they really equip their congregations?
This is a great question, because I think there's a couple of things churches can do, and they're opposite. They're going to sound like opposites. The first thing churches can do is really, I can't stress enough how important it is to provide an environment where it's safe to ask questions. I know several pastors who have now gone to the Q&A model, where they'll give their sermon and then do a Q&A after, or maybe do it on Wednesday nights, where they'll open it up for people to ask whatever they want to ask. So I think that providing an environment where you're teaching really good sound theology, we're going to need more apologetics. I really think we do, because people need reasons to know why they believe what they believe.
Right.
So that would be on one side of things. And on the other side of things, there is a temptation when you are aware of the deconstruction movement to soften your stance, because you don't want to lose people. And you think, oh gosh, if I say this, someone's going to deconstruct, or they're going to view that as toxic, or they're going to view that as
you
unhealthy.
You kind of tiptoe around
can't tiptoe. So what you have to do is sort of provide the environment where the questions can be answered, but you also have to realize that some people do not accept the answers. They don't like the answers. And so it's not that their questions are not answered, it's that they don't like the answers, and you have to be okay with that. There has to come a point where you are not tiptoeing. In fact, I would say there has never been a point in time when pastors need to be more clear about biblical ethics, more clear about what the gospel is, more clear about what the Bible is and why we trust it, and what we say about it, the language we use to describe it, how we interpret it, all of these things. It's never been more important for there to be clarity on those things. And we can't, like, I even found this in my parenting as I studied deconstruction. I found myself kind of, oh, if I say that, my daughter's going to deconstruct. So what I decided, I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to tiptoe around these things. Like, this is what's true. It just, if she's going to be traumatized by learning that 2 + 2 = 4, then she can just be
so
traumatized
be it.
By it, you know, so be it. So I kind of, but also at the same time, I introduced deconstruction to my kids. I say, look, this is a movement. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening. I want to show you a video. Let's talk about it. And I'll even make jokes. Like my daughter told me once that at this old church we went to, we don't go there anymore, but they passed out Twinkies and said, this mm-hmm. is manna. And so they probably said, you know, this is maybe what manna was like, but she heard this is manna.
Sweet.
And I go, good, save that one for your deconstruction story. Right. That'll be a great one. That's and so she laughs. Funny. She's got a wicked sense of humor. So
how
she
old are your kids?
Funny. So I have two older stepkids who are mm-hmm. 30 and 26 mm-hmm. and two grandbabies from the oldest. Aww. And then round two is 15 and 12.
Oh, so you're in the thick of teenage parenting.
Yes.
Wow. We'll be praying for you.
Thank you. I love it. My daughter, I joke with her, she was a difficult baby, yeah. but she is a delightful teenager.
Mm, yeah. Mine are 11 and 9. And something I'm constantly reminding myself of and just kind of wrestling with, like, you have to just go ahead and talk to them about these things.
You
like,
do.
You can't wait.
Because somebody else will
right.
if you don't.
Just real quick, shifting gears, you have two other books as well. We talked a little bit about your newest one, The Deconstruction of Christianity. You also wrote, you kind of landed on the map with another gospel mm-hmm. back in, was that 2021
or
so?
It was 2019, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it might have been 2020. Actually, I think it was 2020.
Sometime around there.
Yeah.
And then Live Your Truth and Other Lies. Just mm-hmm. give us like an overview of those books.
Yeah. So Another Gospel is my spiritual memoir. So it's my story of walking through that faith crisis. What questions did I have? I bring the reader into my darkest mm-hmm. moments and where I found my answers. But then along the way, we also interact with the movement of progressive Christianity and learn how to answer it from a mm-hmm. biblical worldview. So that's Another Gospel. Now, Live Your Truth and Other Lies came about because Another Gospel, I was more addressing the kind of more intellectual theologians of mm-hmm. the progressive movement, but then I noticed there were these social media influencer stars who had millions of followers who were saying the same things that the mm-hmm. theologians were saying, but instead of saying, you know, we reject the doctrine of original sin in favor of original blessing, they were saying things like, you're perfect just as you are, yep. trust your good heart, live your truth,
yep.
you know, God just wants you to be happy, and I'm like, oh, they're saying the same thing. So we kind of went after the more sloganeering of progressive Christianity with Live Your Truth and Other Lies. And then The Deconstruction of Christianity is a unique book. And I say that because there have been a lot of books written to people who are deconstructing. This is not written for the person who's in mm-hmm. deconstruction. It's an analysis of the movement for the benefit of the body of Christ. So this is not for the deconstructionist. Mm-hmm. It's for their moms and dads yeah. and pastors and brothers and mm-hmm. sisters to help understand what's happening to their mm-hmm. loved ones so that they can navigate those relationships. Yeah. And so that one's called The Deconstruction of Christianity.
That's great. And you wrote that with a co-author?
Tim Barnett.
Yes. Great. So in closing, you know, when I'm kind of on a positive note here, we're at a university, so naturally we like to talk about students, but what gives you hope right now?
Mm. Well, especially in the summertime, I get to travel and speak to a lot of students. Most mm-hmm. of the year I'm speaking to adults and women, but in the summertime, there's so many different summer camps. And so I'm speaking to a lot of high school and college mm-hmm. students. And what gives me hope is I'm really seeing like Gen Z and Gen Alpha kind of push back against mm-hmm. the insanity. They're actually seeing the bad fruit of all of this confusion. And so I'm seeing a generation of young Christians who are really wanting to know what they believe and why they believe it. They are becoming very interested in things like apologetics and knowing what their positions are theologically and being mm-hmm. really actively engaged in that way. And that gives me a lot of hope because I always tell Gen Z, I have so much hope for Gen Z. Like and it's not because I believe in you guys, but mm-hmm. I know that you have the same Holy Spirit the church has had for 2,000 mm-hmm. years. You have the same Word of God mm-hmm. that has not changed in 2,000 years. And I believe that we might see the first generation of real persecution among Gen Z. Mm-hmm. And that actually excites me because I know how God grows the church and strengthens the church in times of persecution. And I have a lot of hope in these young people that I get to speak to.
You know, I've heard a few people say those very similar things recently. And what we saw here, you know, in 2023 during the outpouring, and then in the year that's followed, our president has used a term very close to what you've been saying. He's called it the corrective generation. He feels like a lot of these students are going to be I'm using my quotes here for him, for the corrective generation, which I think is so amazing. And we can just hope and pray for these kids that is actually true, because what they're up against is unlike anything probably we have ever seen.
It's like God is shaking up the church because there are just bad you know, movements and theologies mm-hmm. and counterfeit gospels coming at it from all sides. Like, if you reject mm-hmm. this one, there's another waiting for you over here. So this generation is going to have to really know what the gospel mm-hmm. is. And but that excites me because yeah. it's going to, maybe we'll get simple again and just, yeah. you know, like, this is what yeah. the gospel is. We don't need to, yep. you know, pretty it up. We yep. just, this is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And that's a lot of what we saw back in February. It was like confession. Okay, start there. And then there was nothing frilly, you know, mm. it was just very, very real, starting with letting go of that sin and then, you know, living in that freedom. I love that. Well, anything else that you would add in closing?
No, it's just been so great to be here with you. And I loved getting to talk to you and getting to talk to the students. We're looking forward to a great day tomorrow.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the nature of truth and do a Q&A, which is my favorite. I love
getting to
engage. Oh, yeah.
They have some good questions in there
sure
today.
Did.
That was
they
great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here. Really
Absolutely.
Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.